I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to be talking about brain wiring. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. We now have posted at our show website at WNPR.org, dueling viewpoints on ADD or ADHD. We use those terms interchangeably. And the treatment of this. It turns out some people believe that there is a war on treating ADD with pharmaceuticals, while others believe children are overdiagnosed and are pawns of a pharmaceutical industry hungry to sell drugs and boost profits. On our show, we're going to focus on one of the nation's most respected clinicians working with teens and adults who have ADD. Dr. Thomas E. Brown is Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine and Associate Director of the Yale Clinic for Attention and Related Disorders. Dr. Brown's new book, Smart But Stuck, looks at how managing emotions plays a key role in the lives of people with ADD, including those who have exceptionally high IQ scores. Adults and children with ADD are frequently stuck at work, home, school, and in social situations. And Dr. Brown hopes to help them get unstuck by discussing how emotion links to behavior, performance, and success. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Faith. I appreciate your having
me. I like the book. I couldn't wait to get you back here because there is... You know, we're finding out so much now because of our technology and the research that all of you are doing. But this whole zone has been stuck in a way, and there are a lot of people who don't understand how this works. So I'm so glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here, and I know there are a lot of people out there who think they know about what ADHD is, but are operating on notions that just don't fit with what the science is telling us these days.
Now, it's true in medical school that they don't focus on this very much, especially in the zone of prescribing drugs, and so professionals can think they're doing the right thing, but not necessarily.
Yeah, there's not much. There's so much stuff to be covered in the curriculum of medical school, and there's so little time to be able to dig in. In areas related to ADHD, particularly as it applies to adults. You know, the pediatricians and their training get quite a bit of help in learning how to understand, recognize this, and how to treat it. But even today, in many psychiatry programs across the country, and certainly in internal medicine programs, there's very little attention being given to helping those who are taking care of adults and older adolescents to understand what ADHD looks like, what it is, what it isn't, and particularly how to be able to fine-tune the medications which can be helpful to somebody who really does have ADD.
Here's the reason we're doing this show. There are a lot of kids out there who are very smart, and they seem to the parents and family members and educators as if they're not trying hard enough.
Exactly.
And because they are smart in terms of IQ, people think it's an attitude problem. They think it's a willpower issue. And it can be that these are kids with undiagnosed ADD.
Often that's the case. And the reason it looks and it's often thought of as a willpower problem is that every patient that I've ever seen who has ADHD or ADD has a few activities in which they can pay attention and focus and work very well, even though they have a lot of trouble doing these things on almost every other thing they have to do. Now, for some people, it's the way they invest themselves in their sport. For other people, it's the way they do their art. For other people, it's the way they engage in music, making music, listening to music. For other people, it may be reading or writing or mechanical things, taking a car engine apart and putting it back together, or designing computer networks. But the fact is that if you talk with somebody who has ADHD and you say to them, hey, you are so good at paying attention when you're playing soccer or when you're working on your car, but you have so much trouble paying attention to anything else, why is that? Even though you know those things are important, these other things. And typically what they'll say is, it's easy. If it's something I'm interested in, I can pay attention. If not, I can't.
Yeah, you talk about this in your book, these high interest areas that these young people and adults seem to have a lot of energy for.
Yes.
And that's what confuses the supervisors, the grown-ups around them.
And often confuses them.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they see is they've got that energy, they've got that focus, they've got that persistence at staying with it and working with it. But what a lot of people don't understand is that that is not a problem of willpower. It looks like it's willpower, but it's not. It's a problem with the dynamics of the chemistry of the brain. So, if you're doing something you're really, really interested in, not because somebody told you it ought to be interesting, but just because it is for whatever reason, or if you feel like you've got a gun to your head and something very unpleasant is going to be happening very fast if you don't take care of this right here, right now, under those two conditions, it changes the chemistry of the brain instantly. And it makes it look like it's a problem with willpower, but it's not.
So,
because that's not under voluntary control.
Uh-huh. That's not under voluntary control. And what, you know, we fear what we've got out there, because how would parents know about this?
Yeah.
You know, they're not scientists. So, you know, we've got this dialogue going with kids and parents, you know, parents, teachers yelling at these kids, which further crushes these kids, right? Frustrates them.
Because it heightens their feeling of being incompetent. You know, so many of the patients, my specialty is high IQ children and teenagers and adults with ADHD. And almost to a person, they come in reporting that this has just made them feel stupid when they know they're not. Or when people tell them, oh, you're so smart, they're saying to themselves, you don't know the truth. I'm just not that smart. There's so many things I just can't get myself to do.
How do we describe what ADD is?
Well, I think one way of talking about it is simply to say it is the management system of the brain. It used to be everybody thought it was a behavior problem. It's not. Even for those, you know, there are many people with ADD who've never had any significant behavior problems. But even for those who have, that's usually the least of it. It's the problems with attention, with working memory, with being able to keep one thing in mind while doing something else, with being able to focus consistently on something you need to focus on and then shift gears when you've got to shift over to something else.
These all sound like what all of us have to deal with.
Absolutely. If you look at the list of symptoms of ADHD and you ask a group of people, how many of you ever have trouble with this? Everybody's hand would be up. All the problems that people with ADHD have are things everybody has trouble with sometimes. It's just that people with ADD have a lot more trouble with it.
Yet how do you explain, then, that people who have this extra challenge that is, you know, could be quite serious are extraordinarily successful people in all kinds of professions, undiagnosed? How does that happen?
Because they're able to demonstrate their abilities to focus and to put their energy and their creativity into activities which turn them on.
So they're self-selecting.
Yeah.
So they're pointing themselves toward the activity they're good at.
They're drawn to it, and they find that this turns me on. You know, I had a patient years ago who's said to me, I have a sexual example for you for what it's like to have ADD. He said, having ADD is like having erectile dysfunction of the mind. If the task you're trying to do is something that turns you on, you're up for it and you can perform. If the task you're trying to do is not something that's intrinsically interesting, if it doesn't turn you on, you can't get it up. And if you can't get it up, you're not going to be able to perform. And in that situation, it doesn't matter how much you may say to yourself, I need to, I really ought to, I should. You can't make it happen because it's simply not a willpower kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a brilliant kind of description, isn't it? I mean, it's really
a lot of people who have ADD say, that's me.
Yeah, so how many people would you say have ADD out of the whole population?
Well, the best numbers we've got, and these are estimates, and you know, there's some problems with the way they gather them. But for example, the Centers for Disease Control say that it's the number of kids diagnosed with ADD at elementary school age is someplace around 9%.
Okay, and so adults could be around the same thing.
It could be. The last study they had years ago was about 4.5% for adults. But the other thing that's important to say is that there's good evidence about the fact that people with ADHD as kids often are a little bit delayed in the way in which certain parts of brain mature. So that a kid may have a lot of trouble at up to age 12, 15, 18, maybe even 20. And then 3 or 4 years later, they're looking a lot different. They did a study on that at the National Institute of Mental Health, compared a group of about 230 kids carefully diagnosed with ADHD and another group of kids, matched controls, who didn't have it. And what they were looking at was the process of brain maturation. There's a process that we all have as we're growing up, late childhood, where there's a massive proliferation of cortical cells in the brain. And then that's followed, and that peaks usually around puberty. And that's followed by a period of years of pruning to get more efficient circuits in the brain, just like you have to prune a fruit tree in order to get it to produce good fruit. And they did this study where they were looking literally at 40,000 different points in the brain to answer the question of, do people who have ADHD during this period of brain maturation have any different developmental course than the people who don't have ADHD? Because that process of pruning and maturation doesn't usually get completed until around 18 years old, give or take a few years. And what they found was most of the brain development in both groups was identical. Huh. However, there were about five areas, specific areas in the brain, where the group that had the ADHD was running about 3 years behind the developmental stage of the other group. And those happen to be five areas that are particularly important for executive functions, the management system of the brain. And the good news is that for many people, not all, but for many people who have that kind of a maturational delay in brain, specifically on those self-management skills, it gets better a few years later.
There is, this is Dr. Thomas E. Brown. He's a clinical psychologist at Yale, where he teaches. He's a specialist in treating people with ADD, especially very smart, you know, high IQ young adults. And his new book is called Smart But Stuck, because this is what happens. And it is a fascinating look, really, for all of us about how the brain works, how all of us are born with different wiring systems. You know, we're not exactly alike in our wiring systems. These are fair to say that each wiring system is original?
The particular way it's put together, yes. There's certain things that are anatomically similar, but down even at the micro level, there are significant differences between individuals.
So when do we get to this part of the brain called the amygdala and what it does? There is a picture in this book that had my jaw fall open because of all the things that this one little thing makes happen in our brains. Just an astonishing number of connections get made right here in the spots. We're going to get to that. We also want to talk about the controversy right now that is roaring in ADD circles among parents, teachers, in the medical profession. It brings in the drug companies. It all started, that's what we have posted at our website right now, WNPR.org. We have a couple of articles, I think three, and we've got the New York Times, which has recently been saying there is, too liberal a use of drugs, you know, a misdiagnosis of these children who just are energetic, and, you know, so they somehow jumped into this. Then we have an article that appeared in Esquire that really started the controversy, and it was called The Drugging of the American Boy. And according to this story, there was a sense that feminists were at fault because they don't like boys. And so we have this quick diagnosis of boys who have extra energy and a misuse of drugs, and it's all about paying off doctors and profits. Then we saw the New York Observer, we have this posted also, jumping in and saying, how did Esquire get this story so wrong about ADD drugs, and that we're finally starting to get that right? How could they go so wrong on their story, Esquire magazine? Very interesting up there at WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. So, Dr. Brown, what is the most effective combination, based on your years of doing this work, what is the most effective combination of treatment for people regarding drugs and counseling?
The most important thing for people who have ADD is education. To have them get some clear idea, a science-based understanding of what ADHD really is, because there is so much misunderstanding about this out in the general community. And then to get a careful evaluation, because sometimes people think it's ADD when in fact it may be something else or something else with ADD.
Okay, so let's do some things. What are the markers? What are the signs that might lead you to question whether your child or friend has, or yourself, has ADD? Let's do that on the other side of this break. We'll be gone from you for a short second. We've got some information for you, and then we come right back to Thomas Brown and your phone calls if you'd like to jump into the conversation and the controversy. We'll be right back. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Sorry, it's allergy season. Right now, you can also see delicious, easy recipes for dinner. We have value wines for the summer and much more. Right now, you can click on programs at WNPR.org, or to keep it simple, go to foodschmooze.org. We have Dr. Thomas Brown here. He's author of Smart But Stuck. He specializes as a clinical psychologist and teacher in people with ADD, teens and adults, but especially teens who have high IQs and end up finding out that they have ADD. Their parents are baffled about why they don't do better. Their teachers are baffled. They're baffled themselves. And Dr. Brown, can spot. So how do you, what do you look for to signal that ADD might be involved here?
Most of the people who come to see me are coming because they have a suspicion that there's something wrong, because they're so good at being able to focus and work productively in some areas, and they have other very important areas that they also need to be very good at.
And they've been yelled at a lot about this.
They've been often frustrated and confronted by teachers and parents and are frustrated with themselves. You know, this is like a student who's able to organize and pull together information for a research paper that has some wonderfully good ideas for it and is able to talk to you about them but can't get the paper written. Or people who are able to read some things and understand them very, very well, but then they pick up other things that are not that interesting to them, and they read and they get a few pages into it and stop for a second and realize their eyes have gone over every word, they understood every bit of what they read, and now 5 minutes later they haven't got the foggiest idea of what they just read.
Or people, and that's not reading comprehension.
There are certainly some people who can have that as a reading comprehension problem, which is primary. But I'm talking about people whose reading comprehension is excellent for things in which they have high interest and very difficult for them to be able to extract the meanings of what they're reading and remember what they've read if it's not something that has high interest in them. It's the difference between somebody who can be really turned on by a work of fiction and not be able to remember what it said in the social studies text or in the history book that they were working on or
Isn't
in the science
something?
Text.
So here we have all these parents who want only the best for their children, and they see a child failing in all these areas and can't seem to help themselves because they're frustrated and fearful for their children. And so they think, now here comes tough love. You know, what's wrong with you? You've got to be better than this. You've got to be smarter. You know, you've proven you can do it over here.
And you've got to think about your future.
You think about your future. I mean, and on it goes. Yeah. And now we've got this complicating issue for these kids and their self-esteem. So now parents are starting to catch on a little bit about some of this, thanks to your work and the work of others. And we have then parents switching over and trying this line. You can do and be anything you want. You talk about this in your book, Smart But Stuck. Is that helpful?
It's not helpful if it's not taking into account that there are constraints that all of us operate under. And there's some people who can do very well in some areas, but not in another, simply because it's not simply a matter of wanting. It's also a matter of what one's able to do, to say nothing of the openings that there may or not be there to give you an opportunity to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an issue not just for little kids, not just for teenagers, but it's also for adults. That there are many people who have a lot of ability in some areas who, on tasks that call for very similar abilities, are not able to exercise them because they are not able to make themselves do the things they need to do. Now, there are a lot of reasons that that can happen. You know, for example, if somebody is getting stoned three times a day or drinking too much, or terribly depressed, you know, there are other reasons why people can have trouble focusing, other reasons why people can't get their work done. And one of the tasks in doing an evaluation for ADHD is to take a look at other factors that might also explain the difficulty a person's having.
Is there a link between substance abuse and ADD? In other words, that people who have ADD are self-medicating?
Often they are. If you show me a kid who's carefully diagnosed with ADHD at, say, 7 or 8 years old, I can tell you statistically that that kid has double the risk of having a drug or alcohol problem at some point in his or her life. That's been documented a number of times because there's a vulnerability to that. And part of the reason why they're vulnerable is often they get so frustrated with not being able to get the success that they might otherwise be able to get. The way I think of it is if you have somebody with ADHD who's trying to go to school or who's trying to do a job where they are not being adequately treated, it's sort of like you're asking them to run the Boston Marathon with a knapsack of bricks on their back. They can do it, but they have to work a lot harder than everybody else, and they're not going to get the results that would be comparable to somebody else with the same ability and the same amount of effort who just didn't have to carry the bricks.
This is how we see some young people and who have been successful in school despite ADD and have had to work at 50 times the capacity of all the other kids
That's
around
right.
them to get there, right?
Yeah. Many, many long hours of homework time put in because, for one thing, a lot of their time in doing the homework is spent circling the airport. That they have great difficulty in being able to get organized and get prioritize their work, manage the work, and get to it. And that they're often going down the rabbit hole of, you know, chasing one interesting article after another as they go tab after tab on the computer searches. Or they get very interested in texting and doing other things that are quite interesting to them at the time, but that often divert them from the task that they sat down to try to do.
We're going to open the phone lines. If you'd like to join the conversation with us about ADD, we're learning so much more and yet so much more to learn. There's been a controversy in the past couple of years about, in some circles anyway, about the charge that there's been misdiagnosing, that there's been an overuse of medication, and on it goes. So if you'd like to address any of these issues, Dr. Brown is here. This is his special area as a clinical psychologist of research, and we're going to get to the topic of his book, Smart But Stuck, and it is about the role, the critical role that emotion plays for people who have ADD, both positive and negative emotions. Pretty interesting. Mike, welcome to the show. 203-776-9677. Easy way to remember. 203-776-WNPR. Go ahead, Mike.
Dr. Brown described exactly what it was like for me going through school. And I ended up actually dropping out of high school in sophomore year. But then years later, in my early 20s, I went to get my GED. And then went on to college, and I excelled really well. And it's interesting how he says that, you know, your brain, over the course of time, if you have these symptoms when you're younger, your brain may develop as you get older. And I think that's exactly what happened in my case, because as he's describing it, it sounds exactly what I went through when I was younger. I was bored. I was very hard for me to concentrate on, you know, subjects. I would always do really good in the beginning of the year. And as time went on, throughout the year, my grades would suffer as I went, throughout the school year. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Brown, does that sound familiar to you? Did great at the beginning of the year, And then this is where the parents start to think, you know, what happened to your attitude and your work ethic?
Yeah, often, first of all, Mike, your story is one that is matched by many other people. I've had a number of people, for example, who've flunked out of high school or flunked out of their first year of college, and then later have been able to go back and not only do okay, but to do quite well. And it does have to do, at least in many of these cases, with an ADHD problem which has just not been adequately treated, that may not even have been recognized, but the brain maturation itself helps some. But, of course, the problem is that during those years when it's not being treated, it's frustrating to try to go to school, and often people give up because it's too tough to be able to do it and just try and find some other way to make do.
Right.
Well, thank you.
I'm in my early 40s now, so I don't know if this was being diagnosed correctly or even if at all, when I was in school. How long has this science been really coming forward?
It's changed a lot over the last 10 years. Our whole idea of what ADHD is has changed as we've learned more about the brain and how it works. But the fact is there's still a lot of people in the general public and even some people in the professional communities in medicine and mental health and in education who just haven't been able to catch up yet with the science that has helped us get a much clearer understanding of what this is about.
Thank you so much for calling in, Mike.
Thank you.
And best of luck to you. Is that a common statement? It was great for me, or I did well at the beginning of the year, and then I just went careening down.
Yeah, often you're dealing with people who want very much to be successful. And they start out putting forth good effort in it, and there's a kind of excitement about doing it. And this year it's going to be different than what it has been before. Mm-hmm. And then as more and more assignments become due, and as more and more studying needs to be done and term papers need to be completed and so forth, it's just very difficult for them to keep it up.
Hmm. Would you say that the best combination of therapies is both aptly applied drugs and counseling? For people by a counselor who's expert in this, who understands.
Yeah, it helps if you have if you're going to get help from a counselor or a therapist, it's important that it's somebody who really understands what ADD is about. And some, but not all, do. The most effective treatment we have for ADHD is medication. But I want to emphasize that medicine doesn't work for everybody, at least not the medicines we've got right now. I usually talk with patients about this and say, look, we've got an 8 for 10 chance of this medicine helping you.
80%.
Yeah, and for some, it's huge how much the medicine helps them. For others, it's substantial, but it's not huge. Others, it helps a little, but not that much. And 2 out of 10, it doesn't do a damn thing. You know, it's important to be realistic about this and not to act as though somehow we have some magic pill that's going to fix everything. Some people, they know damn well what they ought to be doing, but they just can't get themselves to do it. And for them, having the medication is very much like putting eyeglasses on somebody who can't see very well, that once they've got that correction, they're able to manage things quite well. There are other people who missed out on learning some of the skills, and so they need the medication and some help in developing organizational skills or being able to mm-hmm. learn more about how to take notes in class or how to plan and organize their work. So there's some of that sort of help. And then there are some people who have a lot of emotional baggage that's accrued as a result of untreated ADHD or because of the life situation in which they're operating. And they often need more skilled help in terms of dealing with the emotions that sometimes without their even realizing it cause them to give up too soon or to get flooded with frustration or with annoyance at people who are not immediately going along with what they want to do or with anxiety about how they're going to be able to perform. And in the research that we've done on ADHD, that's an area that hasn't been very much explored, and that's what this new book is about.
The emotions.
It's the emotions and the way in which they shape our responses to things. The brain assigns priorities to tasks on the basis of the emotions that we have associated with that task.
All tasks?
Virtually everything.
Based on emotion.
The brain screens things for us long before we're even consciously aware of what our reaction to it is. And that's you were talking before about the amygdala. That's one particular part of the brain which is in very close contact with many other parts of the brain. And much of this goes on unconsciously. You know, it's so instantaneous. And it sounds amazing, but if you think about what happens when you Google something on the computer and you think about how quickly Google can bring up hundreds of associated websites, the brain's been doing that for human beings for a long, long time. The ability to see something, hear something, think about something.
Make connections.
And then quickly, you've got associative connections being pulled in based on what one has previously experienced with anything that looked like that, felt like that, sounded like that, based upon things you've seen happen to other people or things other people have told you or movies you've seen. And the whole...
And imagination.
And one's own imagination about what might be involved.
That's all centered, to begin with, in the amygdala.
Well, it's centered in not just one part of the brain, but the amygdala is the hub.
The hub. And
of the brain. It helps to make these connections. And then from that, out go other connections.
How many would you say? Can they estimate?
We're talking about... We now know that there are like literally thousands of connections between the amygdala and other parts of the brain, particularly in the prefrontal cortex, but not just there. And it gets reactions to body and to mind, and that's what helps to guide our actions, what things we're going to pay attention to and what things we're just going to blow off.
Does all this research that you have been engaged in and talking about apply equally to males and females?
Absolutely. The interesting thing about it is for years, people have thought about ADHD as mainly a boy problem, a male thing. And the early estimates were 6 boys for every 1 girl, but that was when they were counting kids dragged into child guidance clinics. Then when they did more careful epidemiological studies, they found it was like 3 boys for every 1 girl. And when we look at the clinics that are serving adults, the ratio is much more like 1-to-1. And what that tells us is that there are a lot of girls and women out there who have significant problems with this cluster of difficulties that we call ADHD, who don't get recognized until they're old enough to be able to bring themselves in for consultation because they just seem like they're spaced out or they're just not that much with it.
Interesting. 203-776-WNPR, the Join the Conversation with us. My guest, Dr. Thomas Brown of Yale. His new book is called Smart But Stuck, and it's about the role of emotion in ADD or ADHD. We're going to take a quick break and come right back for your calls, and we'll have more conversation. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR, FaithWNPR, or join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. And thank you for listening, and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. We have posted at our website right now a couple, I guess 3 articles that connect to our topic, and they are pretty fascinating. There is there's quite a controversy out there about ADD, ADD drugs, treatment, people understanding what it is and what it is not, the myths. And so it's at WNPR.org right now. Search programs for The Faith Middleton Show. My guest is Dr. Thomas E. Brown, clinical psychologist at Yale, teacher there, a specialist in treating ADD, especially in teens and adults, teens who have high IQs. By the way, IQ has nothing to do with ADD.
That's absolutely right. You know, there's some people who think if you have ADD, it means you're smarter or that it means you're not as smart. And the reality is, this is distributed right across the range of IQs. There are some people who have ADD who are super, super smart, others high average, middle average, low average, slow, and some people have trouble doing the basics.
Jane Faith Middleton with Dr. Brown. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Brown. I think you're doing a wonderful job of describing what ADD is like for the adult.
Thanks, Jane.
I'm an adult with ADD, and I didn't know about it until my son was diagnosed, and I feel so strongly that medications should be used and must be improved as well. I've been in many discussions with people who object to the use of medications for kids, and I just want to try to explain to them the dire consequences of not doing it, of not treating kids while they're young, because they can end up an adult that's had a totally unsuccessful and unsatisfying career. And that's a very disappointing thing to live with when you look back at it.
It sure is.
Dr. Brown, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that for many people, medicine can make a huge difference. Now, it doesn't work for everybody. And I think we have to be clear about that. But it's also important to know that for medicines that we have for ADHD, and incidentally, we've had the medicines that we use most because we've had them the longest and we've got the most research on them. Methylphenidate we've had since 1956, and the amphetamines we've had since 1937.
That would be Adderall, things like Adderall.
The amphetamines would be Adderall, Vyvanse, Dexedrine, mm-hmm. and the methylphenidates would be like Ritalin, Concerta, Focalin, Metadate.
I used Dexedrine myself, and mm-hmm. for a while the results were wonderful, mm-hmm. and I could go to class and really participate, and my brain was working on all eight cylinders. I could remember mm-hmm. things. It was magnificent, but with time, it started to lose its effectiveness and eventually just started making me sleepy instead of awake and aware. So, you know, this is why I hope there's more research on medications coming down the line.
Jane, that is, you have just hit on something so important. You experienced a change with your drugs, and Dr. Brown was saying to me, I think in a break, that fine-tuning of medicines is critical to taking them.
It really is. And one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that the medicines we use for ADHD are not medicines like some others where you can prescribe according to how old you are, how much you weigh, or how severe the symptoms are. It's how sensitive is your body to it. And, you know, there are some little kids, most little kids are taking very small doses, but there are some kids just as small as the other little kids, same level of symptom severity. We have to go to the top of the adult dosing range to help them because their bodies aren't that sensitive to it. And there's some adults who are quite big and some of them overweight. You know, most of the people that are adults are taking fairly hefty doses, but there are some of them, yeah, among the biggest, who need the smallest doses, no more than you give a typical six-year-old. So the fine-tuning to the person's body chemistry, to the time of day that they need more help or less help, this is critical. And there are some physicians who haven't had much training to be able to adjust these medicines because they're only used for treatment of ADHD and narcolepsy. But your other point is that sometimes a medicine that works for you can begin to lose its effectiveness. And sometimes that's a problem of the fine-tuning not being done adequately. But other times it may be that the medicine just poops out on you. And that's true with antidepressants. It's true with antihistamines. It's true with cardiovascular medications. And the whole field of medication is one where there are times when you need to make a change. And sometimes you can make that change by discontinuing the medicine that's been working that now seems to have lost its effectiveness and trying something else in a slightly different family. And we've got a few options. We don't have a lot of different options, but usually if a person's willing to make some adjustments and make a try, it can be adjusted, and we can usually find something that'll work.
Jane, thank you so much for adding your voice to the show.
Thank you for a great show.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye. It can happen that there are brain wiring issues where when you feel great taking a particular thing, your mind then says to you, well, I'm feeling pretty great. I don't need to take that thing anymore. And then you're back in your original problem again.
Quite frequently.
Okay, so does that also, you know, apply here?
Yeah, because it's important to understand the medications for ADHD cure nothing. It's not like you have strep throat, you take an antibiotic and it knocks out the infection. It's much more like eyeglasses. You know, I've been wearing eyeglasses since I was 10. And my glasses, regardless of how long I wear them, they don't fix my eyesight. They just help to provide correction so that I can see more clearly when I've got them on. I can't read typewriter-sized print without my glasses. Put them on, I read as well as anybody can. Take them off, I'm right back where I started. The glasses don't fix my eyes. They just help me see when I've got them on. And in the same way, these medicines do not cure ADD. But if a person is in the lucky 8 out of 10 for whom the medicine works, the medicine is likely to provide some help for them for being able to cope better with some of the difficulties with memory, some of the difficulties with energy, some of the difficulties with being able to focus and their motivation, and allow them to function better in whatever setting they need to work.
If you are lucky enough to find a doctor who is skilled and understands this kind of fine-tuning, I'm thinking to myself, those doctors must be overrun with clients.
They're pretty busy.
And so how do these poor doctors and these poor patients schedule enough time with each other, considering how this has to be fine-tuned?
Well, the fine-tuning is something which you need to work very closely together over the early weeks and maybe month or two as a person starting. And then it's not like it's going to change every second or third day. It's usually you can get it fine-tuned, and then you sort of check in once a month, once every couple of months, and see how things are going.
Here's the hard question. If you're an employer and you're listening right now, a manager, and you're someone who hires people, you could be listening to this and say, oh, I've got to make sure, I've got to somehow find out whether these people I'm hiring have ADD, because this sounds like it could be a problem. What do you say to that?
What I say to them is, take a look around your workforce, and you may find that some of the people who are your best workers may have ADD. Because the fact is that having ADD doesn't mean simply problems. There often are important strengths that these people carry. Some of them have a unique ability to think outside the box. Some of them have an inexhaustible font of energy to be able to tackle projects. Some of them are people who are particularly good at being able to interact with other people. Now, that's not the whole story. There certainly are some people who are chronically late. There are some people who have difficulty in being able to – they might be great salespersons and yet not be able to get their expense accounts in on time. But the fact is the work that's been done to study this suggests that there are many people with ADHD who are extremely effective workers, even though they may have considerable difficulty in some other areas of their lives.
Okay. Including social relationships, right? Including
exactly.
Marriages.
There are some people with ADHD who are wonderfully personable. They're great fun to be with. They add the life to the party and are good at listening and dealing with other people. And there are some people who have ADHD whose difficulties really get in the way of their being able to interact with other people, that they're too quick to jump to conclusions, or they get flooded with enthusiasm or flooded with frustration or flooded with anger or hopelessness way earlier than most other people would.
Here's where you're getting into the real subject of your book, Smart But Stuck. The role of emotions, and I want to talk with you. Let's take a call, and then I want to talk with you about that. Well, this flooding of the brain with a predominant emotion. So that's so interesting that happens. Justin, Faith Middleton with Dr. Thomas Brown.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're great, Justin. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Justin.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to touch upon the point with possible issues with parents that kind of just avoid reality and prescribe drugs to their kids, kind of just abandoning them. I went to, I did 3 years of public school, and then my senior year in high school, I went to a private school. And at lunchtime, the nurse would go around with packets of medication for like half the kids there. And it seemed like they were just avoiding some of the parenting, and at some points I felt like maybe the parents need to get some sort of diagnosis on what they're doing with their children. I'm not saying all cases, but for some of them I felt like they just got shipped off to this boarding school and left by themselves, and making friends with these other kids that are on medication. So a lot of it was antidepressants, but there was plenty of ADHD medications around. And a lot of the kids ended up abusing these drugs, to get high, and they'd be happy to get their prescriptions increased just for that point.
Okay, let's look at this. Let's talk about this, Justin. Thank you so much for that, Dr. Brown. To what extent does this go on?
Well, it certainly does happen, mm-hmm. And it's certainly true that there are a number of kids and some adults, high school kids and college kids most frequently, perhaps, who do borrow somebody else's medicine for ADHD or buy somebody else's medicine in order to try to help them. In my experience, it's less often that they are doing it to get high and more often that they're trying to pull an all-nighter in order to make up for all the work they should have done the previous 3 weeks.
So exams are coming.
Exams are coming, or I've got a paper and I've got a take-home exam I've got to do, and on top of that I've got to study for an important test. There are a lot of reasons why students – I see a lot of very bright students who have been struggling to get through school because they can't keep up on their work and they sort of have these sort of binge efforts to study. And when they get medicine, if it works, and they're taking it on a regular basis, they find it's easier for them to be able to get the work done a bit at a time as it's assigned rather than having a big crunch all at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
But your earlier point about the fact that medicine alone doesn't fix things. And just sending somebody off to boarding school doesn't necessarily fix things. That, you know, there's a lot of support that people need, and that particularly kids need as they're growing up, to be able to help them cope with some of the frustrations that they've got to deal with.
I remember seeing a documentary about children at a theater camp. And I was watching on film as the kids lined up outside the so-called nurse's door and were given these packets of their medications. And I remember looking at it and thinking, what in the world is that about? Are they medicating these children because they're these kind of wild, creative kids? And I mean, they were so talented, these kids. Or, you know, these kids all self-selected to this area and are so good at this because this is what they love. And yes, they probably have ADD and they're all taking these meds. Well, I mean, do we have places that are just medicating children right and left for behavior issues?
Some, and sometimes it's for the convenience of the adults to be able to help, you know, kids behave. But the other situation is that there's sometimes when there are some real difficulties. Now, I think the argument about medication is one where, you know, it makes no sense to look at it just from one extreme or the other. There are some cases where people are being given medicine mm-hmm. without having had an adequate evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And where, for example, they're trying to treat somebody who has ADD with heavy doses of medicine when, in fact, the problem is they're getting stoned 3 times a day. And that the medicine is not going to change their ability to function academically if they've got that much THC in their system. There are some people who are struggling with a lot of depressive feelings because they've got a lot of difficulties interpersonally or family problems they're struggling with. You know, there are other things that need to be taken into account. And when somebody's having a lot of trouble and it looks like an ADHD and they're not responding to the usual treatments, it's important to take another look at the evaluation and see if there maybe is something else that's going uh-huh. on that might need a different approach.
Can you talk about your area of special interest, especially in this book, Smart But Stuck? Lots of case stories of people talking and what's happened to them. In this minute that we have left, there is a primary emotion in people with ADD that can flood the brain, and you can only pay attention really to that one emotion.
Yeah, it's like there's a sort of single-minded focus on this one thing, that I am so angry that I'm going to chew out my kid and really scold him and let him know how this is going to ruin his whole life and forget this is my kid whom I'm trying to help to learn how to think of himself as a good person and help to build on his strengths and not just tackle him.
So the flood of emotions, both positive and negative, that focus on one thing. Thank you so much, Dr. Thomas E. Brown, author of Smart But Stuck. And we hope you will join us. As always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines that we feature right now at foodschmooze.org or WNPR.org. Click on programs.